Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, President Trump is speaking to Republicans at the beginning of a three-day, mostly closed-door GOP retreat in Philadelphia. Before the retreat, Speaker of the House Paul Ryan and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell spoke with reporters about their legislative agenda and the president's as well. Here's Ryan addressing the wall Donald Trump wants to build on the border.
We are going to finance the Secure Fence Act, which is the construction of the physical barrier on the border. We have ambitious goals and ambitious timelines. Our goal is to get these laws done in 2017.
That was earlier today. Also on the agenda, how to repeal the Affordable Care Act, reform the tax code, scale back Obama-era regulations. Theresa May, Prime Minister of the UK, is visiting later today, expected to address Republican lawmakers then. And last night, President Trump gave his first TV interview as president, doubling down on unsubstantiated claims of voter fraud and his pledge to build a wall. Let's bring in NPR's political reporter, Jessica Taylor. And Jessica, it's thought that this retreat is an opportunity for the president and congressional Republicans to get on the same page. As Senator Ron Johnson said, how could we be on the same page? Many of us haven't met him yet. And they have vocally disagreed.
Yeah, I mean, some of these things that President Trump continues to harp upon, like these unsubstantiated voter fraud claims and, talking about the wall and different things, which they, you know, how they would pay for it, continually talking about the crowd sizes and debate over that. I mean, this is deflected from their agenda. This is not what they want to be talking about. This is supposed to be a unified Republican judgment. And instead, we're sort of seeing this same campaign trail Trump that we saw that had this ability to sort of get sidetracked onto really minute things that in the large scheme of things should not matter.
Well, in his interview with ABC's David Muir last night, we heard about a lot of those things. What jumped out at you?
This voter fraud allegations, this is something that he is completely doubling down on and wants to order a federal investigation into it. Now, to be clear, the studies and things that he has cited have found no evidence of voter fraud. There was even a 2007 investigation by the Bush administration that found very scant evidence of any sort of systematic voter fraud that would influence federal elections. And, you know, this seems predicated by the fact that he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton, and he seems to want to make up that margin in some way. So here's what he told David Muir.
We're going to launch an investigation to find out. And then the next time, and I will say this, of those votes cast, none of them come to me. None of them come to me. They would all be for the other side. None of them come to me. But when you look at the people that are registered, dead, illegal, and two states, and some cases maybe three states, we have a lot to look into.
Look, as you know, Jessica, people are pointing out that even some in his own administration are registered in two states. And Terry Lynn Roach was the voter who was arrested in Des Moines voting twice, but it was twice for Trump. So that's going to be continually litigated. But what else from this interview caught your attention?
You know, the first full day of the Trump administration last Saturday, he went to the CIA. He had criticized them in the past over their findings that Russia had looked to be involved to influence the elections. And he stood in front of this wall of heroes that they have there that memorializes intelligence officers that lost their lives in the line of duty. And he gave what essentially, again, sounded like a campaign speech, rambling off, talking about his crowds and stuff, too, saying, you know, just how great they were. And there were 1 million to 1.5 million when clearly you look at the photos. And, you know, we're not making any estimates here at NPR, but there was a much larger crowd at President Obama's 2009 inauguration than there was at Trump's. And he still continued to harp on this. And here's what he told David Muir again here.
I have great respect for the people in intelligence and CIA. I don't have a lot of respect for, in particular, one of the leaders, but that's okay. But I have a lot of respect for the people in the CIA. That speech was a home run. That speech, if you look at Fox, okay, I'll mention it in your network, see what Fox said. They said it was one of the great speeches. They showed the people applauding and screaming, and they were all CIA. There was nobody. Somebody was asking Sean, Well, were they Trump people that were? We don't have Trump people. They were CIA people.
Well, then again, the question to him from David Muir was it appropriate to speak that way in front of this wall of the stars of the fallen? Look, yesterday, Donald Trump also signed executive orders to build the wall. He's long promised, insisting one way or another Mexico will pay for that wall. We're hearing today Mexico's president, Peña Nieto, now saying he will not make that scheduled visit to the White House next week. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, this is just happening. You know, his many Mexican lawmakers had urged him not to come. This was supposed to be sort of a way to sort of ease tensions between some of the things that Trump had said on the campaign trail and his rhetoric against Mexican immigrants and what largely people saw as the Mexican people. And so now that he is not coming, I mean, this maybe could have been a way for them to try to reconcile this, to try to ease diplomatic relations with someone who is our neighbor to the south. And so I think this seems to have exacerbated tensions. And the fact that, you know, we have, you know, leaders, Republican leaders are saying they will find a way to finance this. But now it's changed a little bit, saying that, you know, we'll front the money, but Mexico is still going to pay for it somehow. Mexico, President Peña Nieto has said very forcefully, like, we are not paying for this. So they've got to find some other way to pay for this, whether it explodes the deficit or whether they could put sanctions or reduce aid in some way to Mexico.
We just have a few seconds here. President Trump also wants to reopen CIA-run black box prisons, bring back waterboarding, torture. Some Republicans saying you can't even do that. It's not legal. What would you say the mood is going into this retreat?
I think they're a little perplexed, again, at why he keeps bringing this up, because during his confirmation hearings of, you know, people like Defense Secretary Mattis and now CIA Director Pompeo, they were very clear on the fact that they believed that this was enhanced interrogation, that they would not back this. And so he seems to have sort of walked this back and going against even his top advisors.
That's NPR political reporter Jessica Taylor. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, word that President Trump is planning to sign an executive order suspending visas on people from predominantly Muslim countries prompted former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to tweet, "I was raised Catholic, became Episcopalian, and found out later my family was Jewish. I stand ready to register as a Muslim in solidarity." There's been no official announcement about any Muslim registry, although Trump did say he would create one during the campaign. One thing we do know is that Muslim Americans have seen a spike in verbal and physical attacks since the election. The latest FBI data show hate crimes against Muslims increasing. A number of Muslim women have reported being targeted for wearing a headscarf or hijab. So some are choosing to be prepared and, if necessary, fight back. Carmel Dulshad of Here and Now contributor WAMU has our story from College Park, Maryland.
With a hammer fist and a twist of the hip, Aram Beg maneuvers out of an attack.
Well, you do the elbow. You grab this elbow.
Beg is at a self-defense class at an Islamic school in College Park. She's joined by a few dozen women, all looking to learn the same thing: how to fend off a potential attacker.
I understand something like this can happen to me, and so I want to be prepared for it.
The instructors are Mohib Rahman and Aisha Akhtar, a husband and wife black belt duo. They show women what to do if someone tries to grab them by the neck, or by their hijab, the veil worn by some Muslim women.
What we're showing now is you can use your palm, the heel of your palm, you can use your hammer fist, right?
Rahman says he was surprised by how many women showed up to this free training with little advance notice.
A lot of it may be the political climate. Some people feel like there is an element of Islamophobic environment out there.
The Council on American Islamic Relations, a Muslim civil rights group, is sponsoring the training. CARE tracks incidents where they believe religious bias was a factor. According to their preliminary data, hijabs were a major trigger for anti-Muslim incidents during the first 9 months of 2016. Mark Potok is with the Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate incidents across the country. He says the current political climate is contributing to the rise in anti-Muslim hate.
This is pretty much the worst we've seen, going all the way back to 9/11.
Potok says the center noticed a rash of hate incidents immediately after the election, so it started tracking them. Of the nearly 1,100 hate incidents aimed at mostly minorities and immigrants, at least 112 of them were anti-Muslim. Potok says the center believes many of the verbal and physical incidents were committed by Trump supporters who used Trump's name, his campaign slogans, or his remarks about sexual assault.
It is as if Donald Trump and his campaign lifted the lid on Pandora's box, and all of these really awful hatreds and bigotries have escaped, and they're not going to be easy to get back into the box.
It's part of a growing trend of attacks against American Muslims. The FBI reports 257 assaults, attacks on mosques, and other hate crimes in 2015. The only other time they were higher was in 2001, after the 9/11 attacks. Potok believes the upward trend is likely to get worse as reports of hate incidents continue to trickle in. And just in case it does get worse, Sarah Sanchez says she wants to be prepared. That's why she's at the karate studio learning how to defend herself, although she says she may already have a leg up.
I'm an American Muslim from Brooklyn, New York, so aggression is actually my middle name. I have no problem with aggression.
Sanchez is the mother of four girls, and she says she worries about them all the time. She's fearful of anti-Muslim sentiment reaching a boiling point, so she brought two of her daughters with her to the class.
You know, we always wait until things start to happen, and then we want to fix it. But now we got to do it. Now our backs are up against the wall, so to speak.
As the group of women practice maneuvering away from an attack, the instructors tell them their technique isn't as important as their voice.
Say no, as loud as you can.
As loud as you can.
Say no.
Yell, scream, and make a scene, the instructors say. It may just save your life. And to that, Sarah Sanchez says, no problem.
I may not know karate, but I know crazy.
For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad.
This morning, the U.S. Drought Monitor reported that just 2% of California is now in extreme drought. That's down from 24% last week. Overall, 51% of the state is in some level of drought, down from 95% a year ago. California's seen heavy rain and snow over the past few weeks, leading many to ask, is the drought essentially over? Paul Rogers is managing editor of the Science Unit for KQED in San Francisco, part of our Contributors Network. He's also an environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So is the drought over?
You know, that has been a topic of conversation in California for more than a year now. Everybody on the right, the left, up, down, all ethnicities, that question is on their lips. And the answer, at least as far as scientists will go right now, is it's over in about half of the state. If you draw a line in the northern part of the state from San Francisco across to Lake Tahoe, virtually everything north of that to Oregon is finally out of the drought. Everything south of that, however, all the way down to Los Angeles and the Central Valley, those areas have not gotten enough rain. Their reservoirs still aren't in very good shape, and they're still in drought conditions.
Well, how do they measure the level of drought? Because I'm one of these people that likes to occasionally check on the U.S. Drought Monitor website. It's fascinating. You can see the different colors of the levels of drought in different places. And sometimes I've noticed that when there's been a storm in California, maybe they'll reduce the level of drought the following week, but sometimes they don't. So how do they measure that?
Yeah, you know, drought is actually more of a term of art than a term of science. Mm. And Governor Jerry Brown still has California in a legally declared drought emergency, which began in January of 2014. We have been in the worst drought in state history back to 1850 when California first became a state. So it's a big deal. Farmers' wells have gone dry. You know, billions of dollars have been lost. Forest fires have been more at risk, things like that. But as we get more and more rain this year, the federal scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they look at lots of different metrics, everything from soil moisture to reservoir levels to groundwater levels, and they come up with this system, a map of different colors, red, orange, yellow, and it is updated every week. And we've really been trending in the right direction. Right now, about half of the state is out of drought. A year ago at this time, it was only 3%.
Hmm. Well, we know that one of the concerns in California throughout the drought has been that because of the drought, people have been using the water in the underground reservoirs and that they were emptying out. What's the status of those reservoirs now?
Yeah, it's a great question. Everyone in the state who sees the rain and the huge snow blizzards that we've been having up in the Sierra Nevada, that's the rain and the precipitation you can see. And you can see reservoirs filling to levels they haven't been at for 5 or 6 years, which is great news. But we do have a lot of the water for cities and farms comes from the water table, from wells. And so during the worst parts of the drought in 2014 and 15, particularly in the farm areas of California. And remember, California is the number one agricultural state by dollar amount in the United States. So in a lot of these places, farmers drew their wells down much, much lower than they had ever done before because there just wasn't any reservoir water and there wasn't any rainfall. And in some places, they were using water that is 20,000 years old. So that's going to take a long time to recover.
One of the things that many in California thought would be a big savior of the drought was El Nino. In 2015, it wasn't a savior of the drought, but then this year we're getting these big storms. What are scientists saying about that?
Yeah, what's been happening in the last couple of years in California and the Pacific with weather is just absolutely fascinating, even for people who aren't weather nerds. And basically, there are a lot of storms that come off from Hawaii and Alaska every year, and in the wintertime, they soak the West Coast. But what happened over the last few years was we got this huge bubble of high-pressure air off the coast, and it was called the Ridiculously Resilient Ridge. And it was almost like a big stone in a river. And so these storms would come barreling off the Pacific. They'd hit this air mass, and they would be pushed up into Canada. They'd get really cold, and all the snow would come down in the Midwest and in the East Coast. So you remember the polar vortex.
Yeah.
That was our rain that we were supposed to get in California.
That was yours.
And we thought that El Nino was just going to bust through that. You know, El Nino is a time when the ocean's warmer than normal, and it often creates wet conditions in California. Well, for reasons that scientists still don't understand, even though we had all-time record warm temperatures in the Pacific Ocean a year ago, the storms came, but they came 500 miles further north than anyone expected. So we were all expecting Hollywood to get soaked with rain. And in fact, Seattle and Oregon got soaked with rain. So this year was supposed to be a mild La Nina, where the ocean's a little cooler. And that should have meant drier than normal conditions were favored in California. But here we are getting absolutely soaked. So scientists at this point, they're not really sure what's happening. If it's just that we have a few too many data points, or if it's that climate change is beginning to change some of our assumptions, but we're very happy to get all this rain, I can tell you that.
Are people in California still being asked to conserve water?
It depends where you live. Yeah, in some of the drier areas, they are. But in many of the cities, particularly in the north, ever since last summer, the more strict regulations, like you can only water your grass 1 or 2 days a week, those kind of things have been lifted. However, the state has put in place some permanent water wasting rules, basic things like you can't hose down your driveway and you can't wash your car unless you have a nozzle on the hose and you can't run a fountain unless it recycles the water. Those rules are going to stay in place forever and will be one of the legacies of the drought, even as we continue to come out of it.
Well, and do you think that people have changed their behavior permanently because of this drought, that they've learned to live in California, a relatively dry state, and maybe decide not to have a lawn in front of their house, but in fact have a rock garden or something like that?
You know, one of the most fascinating things to me about California history is that as people came here in the 1920s and 30s and 40s, they often came from the East where everybody has lawns. And so they wanted to have lawns too. But Los Angeles and San Jose, where Silicon Valley is, they both get 15 inches of rain a year on average. 15 inches. That's the same amount as Casablanca, Morocco. So you can't just pick up the same gardening patterns that you might have in Cincinnati, Ohio, and put them down in Southern California. And we built the world's largest system of dams and canals and pumps to make this dry area bloom and to allow Hollywood and Silicon Valley and the Central Valley. But now this drought has really reminded people that there are limits. And I think we're still seeing water conservation, even as the drought eases. It's become part of a lot of people's daily activity. You're even seeing, you know, people who took out their lawns and replaced them with drought-tolerant plants, or people who put in place low-flush toilets and things like that. They're not ripping those out. So those savings will be permanent going forward.
That's Paul Rogers, managing editor of the Science Unit for KQED in San Francisco, part of our Contributors Network. He's also an environment writer for the San Jose Mercury News. Paul, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we started this hour with the Republican Party retreat at Philadelphia's Center City. Well, scores of protesters are rallying in Philadelphia, but just west of the Center City, another group of protesters recently won a victory in a fight with decidedly lower stakes. It's the right to sit on the walls of the city's most popular park. Bobby Allen from Here Now contributor WHYY explains.
Rittenhouse Square is a compact public park surrounded by fancy bistros and elegant old buildings in one of the city's most elite neighborhoods. And the 3-foot concrete walls around the park's fountain are more popular than the rows of benches. People have congregated on the park's walls for generations. Among them, Ursula Corral.
People play chess, they kiss one another, they make love sitting on the wall. It's wonderful.
But Rittenhouse residents were sick of the loiterers and pot smokers among the wall sitters and requested a ban on using the park's walls as a perch. And the city agreed. Richard Branton was pleased.
What's so magical about sitting on the wall? It provides an opportunity for undesirable people with undesirable intentions to pass drugs.
Those kinds of views sparked a public outcry on social media. In response, the city quickly took down the no-sitting signs along the wall, and the mayor tweeted, "Sit where you want." To celebrate, dozens gathered recently for what they called a sittin' house gathering to show support for lounging on the walls. Sachioko Wen was there.
Certainly this little move of not letting people sit on the balustrade or wall, whatever you want to call it, is about race and social class. It's something that was not expected to be noticed. A little tiny thing that's a statement of who belongs here and who doesn't.
During the 60s, Rittenhouse was ground zero for beatniks, artists, and anti-war activists who won a right to be there when a federal judge ruled that, quote, it is not a crime to be a hippie. But area resident Vicky Bale cites a shooting that occurred near the park in October that put the community on edge. She says the wall-sitting ban needs to come back.
It's a good idea because we're getting rid of the drugs and all of the hanging out here and smoking pot and or doing whatever drugs there are. That element was not always part of Rittenhouse Square.
I've never seen drug dealers, and I'm here every other day and hours in the summer and the spring.
That's Mina Smith Siegel, who often paints portraits of people on the wall. Another frequent visitor, Howard Zerlich, says the park's benches are fine, but the walls have always been a little more special.
This is just part of Philadelphia. To remove this is just like saying you can't look at the Liberty Bell. You know, you can't go here, you can't go there.
Which might still happen. Even after the mayor's tweet, a private guard hired by the neighbors told me to get off the wall. And the neighbors say they'll keep paying those guards to patrol the park. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Philadelphia.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original before-you-go toilet spray that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
At the office, there are all kinds of things that can be done to improve morale and productivity. Harvard Business Review has been looking into some of the things that don't work. And Kurt Nickisch, senior editor there, joins us now. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And one of them, it sounds like, is don't be rude, because rudeness can actually hurt productivity.
Yeah. I mean, you've probably been talking about civility a lot lately, yeah. But we're going to talk about it here in the office. It turns out that just interrupting somebody, even not even thinking that you're doing that, can cause somebody else in your team to close up a little bit and feel a little less psychologically safe. And over time, this civility can add up, or incivility can add up, and you can really have teams that are just not as productive because they just don't share as much with each other. And it's almost imperceptible, too.
So what can a manager do about that? Just say to their employee, don't be rude?
Yeah, a little more than that, but that's basically it. You have to set the tone from the top, and you have to talk about it. So there's a law firm in California. They spent about an hour just with employees, just coming up with kind of what they thought the norms should be. They wrote up a civility code that they put in the office, and they think that has a lot to do with the fact that they were rated, you know, one of the top 10 places to work in Orange County.
There's another thing that the Harvard Business Review has been looking into that is also apparently not a good idea for companies that want to boost morale and productivity, and that is things like karaoke nights. The company says, you know what, the team's going to meet later this week for karaoke. We'll all have fun. It'll be a great, you know, team building exercise. Why is that not good?
Well, companies spend a lot of money on these kind of sort of what seems to be like a kind of obvious present thing that you can do to kind of build the team and get everybody comfortable with each other. But the fact is, if you just spend more time looking at trust in your organization and fostering a culture of trust, that pays off way more than than in these kinds of investments.
How do you do that? How do you build trust?
So you, again, set it from the top down. Managers need to think of themselves not as micromanagers. They need to think of themselves as coaches. They need to set goals, but then serve the team, coach the team, and at the end say thank you. And when you do things more like that, you build up a culture of trust in the organization where people feel safe to fail or make mistakes without being punished for it. And you end up being better and be more productive.
Let's listen to Paul Zak, who's at Claremont Graduate University. He told the Harvard Business Review that he found evidence to what you're talking about, that trust boosts productivity.
We have found in the U.S. that people who work in high-trust organizations earn more. So the only way you can earn more money in this organization relative to every other organization, given competitive labor markets, is if you're more productive.
Okay, so build trust, don't have karaoke nights, don't be rude to your coworkers. Anything else?
I think those are great places to start. Just first measure what kind of culture you have and then work at on improving it.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, and we will link you to more about each of these studies if you are in a workplace that needs a little help with morale and productivity at our website, hereandnow.org. Kurt, thank you.
My pleasure.
Last night, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh said that if President Trump deports undocumented immigrants, Walsh will give them sanctuary in City Hall. And Boston is not a sanctuary city. New York, Oakland, Chicago are joining hundreds of cities and counties declaring their local police won't cooperate with federal immigration officials. Yesterday, Donald Trump signed an executive order to pull federal funds from them. So now what? Earlier this month, Syracuse, New York Mayor Stephanie Miner declared Syracuse a sanctuary city. Mayor Miner, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, part of the way this works in many of these cities is if someone is arrested for a crime, anyone, they're fingerprinted, fingerprints are sent to the FBI and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. If they, ICE, determined that person is undocumented, they ask the city to hold the person while they get a warrant. Sometimes it can be up for 48 hours. Is that part of what you are refusing to do?
Well, that is actually covered by the Sheriff's Department in my jurisdiction. What we have said is that we are not going to have our police department and our police officers ask people about their immigration status or stop them because of their immigration status. In effect, what we are saying very directly is we are not going to use our police department to enforce federal immigration law. And as a matter of settled law, the President of the United States can't do that. The courts have held that you cannot mandate a locality to use its forces to enforce a civil law like immigration.
Well, are you referring to the 2014 ruling by a judge in Oregon who said that holding someone violates the Fourth Amendment guarantee of freedom from unlawful search and seizure? And I'm not sure if that was in response to requests from ICE to hold someone.
And my understanding it was, but there's a whole, if you will, constellation of laws that enforce this idea. And, you know, it goes part and parcel along with our notion of federalism, that the federal government and state and local governments have different areas of rights and responsibilities, and one government cannot mandate that another government follow those procedures. Now, sometimes it does happen. Governments enter into partnerships and there's agreements. But with this particular matter, again, immigration laws are civil laws, and the federal government cannot say to the city of Syracuse, you have to take your public safety officers and have them enforce immigration civil laws. And so we are not going to do that. But most importantly, I think this is really about, at this point, this is really about public policy. And I think it goes to the very heart of who we are as Americans and what we stand for. The history of the city of Syracuse is a history of being a sanctuary city, going back to the abolition movement, back to, you know, the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement. These are values that are near and dear to us. We are a city that was built by immigrants and we are filled with immigrants and both new Americans and multi-generations who have come from Western Europe and other places. This is not who we are, and we are going to exercise our rights as Americans to stand up and say that we don't think that this policy is right, we don't think it's just, and we're going to stand for the values as we see them as Americans.
Well, so you say that there are some moral issues for you, obviously, that you've just laid out. Before that, some legal issues. You think there should be a division between what the local police and what the federal authorities do. But are there other reasons that you don't want your local police to be looking around for undocumented immigrants?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, we spend a great deal of our time making sure that we have good relationships between our neighbors and our citizens and the police department. They are our most important tool to fight crime. And if you empower your police officers to go around and question people, which essentially you'd be questioning people based on what they look like or how they speak or what language they are, you would be, in essence, saying that an American is somebody who is white and speaks English. We're not going to do that. And what we have learned firsthand, we have a burgeoning population of new Americans that we're thrilled to have from all over the world. But what we have learned is that new Americans and immigrants are the victims of crime. They're not the perpetrators of crime. So what the president has done with this executive order, it has really flipped what the reality is in most places in the United States. And I say most places because I have not spoken to a mayor or a local government official in my 8 years as mayor who has ever said to me, boy, we have a huge problem with illegal immigrants committing crimes.
Well, look, you said a few things here. Let's take the rate of crime. Others say the same thing, including commentary in the Wall Street Journal, the very conservative Wall Street Journal op-ed page, pointing out that the Immigration Policy Center notes that while the illegal immigrant population tripled in 1990 to 2013, that's when it rose the most. FBI data at the same time showed that the violent crime rate declined 48%, and that included falling rates across the board of all crime, but also across every ethnic group. Every ethnic group, without exception, incarceration rates among young men are lowest for immigrants. So people are holding up statistics to point to what you've said. But what do you say, though, to the mothers that we've heard from whose children have been murdered by undocumented immigrants, the Remembrance Project nonprofit, which is anti-undocumented immigration, has highlighted their stories? Statistically, as we said, they're less likely to commit crimes. They're more likely to be the victim of crimes, if, in fact, they're also hiding from the police who they think are looking for them. But what if it's just one horrendous crime on your watch in your city?
Look, my heart goes out to mothers, all mothers who have lost sons and daughters. Every death, every murder is a tragedy. But when you hold up what are exceptions to make rules, what you end up with is bad public policy. And in this case, not just bad public policy, but public policy that runs completely counter to who we are as Americans, our history of when we've been the best as Americans. And what it does is really allow people to engage in or continue with destructive stereotypes and downright lies that just simply aren't true. And that's where I think it's important for elected officials, and that's why I decided to advocate, to say, what you are saying, don't use the death and tragedy of mothers to institute bad public policy that's based on lies.
Well, what about funding? Grants. The DOJ just gave Syracuse $59,000 for police cameras. A school district there got $1 million last year. Can you withstand losing the federal funding?
You know, when I just made the decision to become a sanctuary city and to make this very public statement, that was part of the risk assessment that I and my administration that we talked about. And so you cannot cower to threats of funding when they're asking you to go against your values. And that's what my job is as a mayor, is to stand up and advocate for the people of the city and to not be bullied into this. If you can't stand up for your values, then they really aren't worth it. And so is this a risk? Of course it is. Am I worried about it? Yes.
Well, but how far are you willing to go when it comes to the undocumented immigrants? Will you throw up in City Hall? I mean, how far are you willing to go? And by the way, this isn't about refugees. This isn't about, you know, the Syrian refugees. This is about undocumented immigrants who've crossed borders. Refugees have been brought in through different processes. Are you willing to surround them with your police?
You know, what I will tell you right now is that I am willing to stand up in the court of public opinion, in a court of law, and advocate for the values and the law as we see it. And these will be decisions that we move forward. But I can tell you that if the Department of Justice offers us a grant for body cameras and then says you can't have that grant for body cameras because you're a sanctuary city, that, you know, those are the kind of decisions that we make every day, because we have to determine what is in the best interest of our community. And what's in the best interest of our community is that we have neighbors that trust the police, that work with the police, and that we will say to people, don't be victimized by crime. Come out and talk to us and work with us. If we have a policy position where we separate people, or they're afraid of our police, or they're afraid of us and not talk to us, that does a tremendous amount of destruction in the city of Syracuse.
That's Stephanie Miner, mayor of Syracuse, a sanctuary city there in New York. Mayor Miner, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay, a fun note in a serious week. The bad lip-reading video of the Trump inauguration is out. This is that anonymous Texas music producer who imagines what presidents and others might be saying. So when Donald Trump and Barack Obama were standing together, it went like this.
You know, you might want to clean my car after this.
I really wouldn't call it yours, right? Because you got to go back to the Jetta. Pretty dorky. Yeah.
What would we do without bad lip-reading? We'll link you. At hereandnow.org.
I'm going to figure out a way to bury your stuff fast. Okay. I'm burying your junk already.
Well, that's my past.
We're now in day 7 of the new administration of President Trump, and it seems as if the already breakneck pace of news has been turbocharged. That leads to challenges for journalists and people who are reading, watching, and listening to the news. So what to do? Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
So I want to just go through what happened on Tuesday, just to give people a sense of how quickly the news is breaking right now. Tuesday morning, President Trump met with auto executives. Then he signed executive orders to move ahead with the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines. There was the press conference with Sean Spicer in the early afternoon. And then the president went on to tweet throughout the night and the next morning about Fox News ratings, potentially sending feds in to help Chicago deal with crime, building the wall, and investigating what he saw as voter fraud during the election. It's a lot of stuff. It's coming at a much faster pace than we've been used to. How do news organizations keep up and decide what to cover and what not to cover?
It's a little like taking incoming fire from everywhere. You got to kind of pick your spots a bit. Even major news organizations are having to make some tough choices on the fly. And sometimes it's not a question of, are we going to cover something at all, but how many resources, how many people are we going to devote to a certain story at a given moment? You know, news organizations are having to say, these are moments that are real as opposed to head faints or merely rhetorical ones. We're going to have to burrow down. Let's go at the ones of real substance that are signaling not only the possibility of shifts, but actual shifts in how government is functioning. And we promise we're going to hustle and try to get to the others as soon as we can.
What about the idea that the Trump team may want to distract the media with a tweet about something that will get everyone's attention, let's say inauguration crowd size, for example, so that people don't focus on some of the other things that they're doing?
I don't think you can underestimate the personal factor when it comes to this president in particular. It's not that Donald Trump has a thin skin. He has essentially no skin. And so I think he genuinely was outraged by all accounts, and certainly from what we know of him, by what he saw on cable TV and on Twitter about what was the headcount for his rally. Some people were noting that it may have been larger. In fact, it was quite a bit larger for President Obama's first inauguration. That set him off. This should be a celebration of him. He wasn't getting his due. By the same token, the tweeting and the rhetorical blasts at the press and the surprises and the outrages are functioning to overwhelm the press's ability to winnow, I think, particularly effectively. I saw one guy online described it as like a denial of service. That is, it's almost crashing the servers of the media's ability to mentally process things as opposed to process things online. And so, you know, yeah, there's a lot of quick twitch reaction to certain things that seem like in the moment they're incredibly important. But I think that diverts both reporters' energies and attention, and it also diverts the ability of the bandwidth of the consumers in being able to process what is it that we're supposed to take seriously. After all, on Twitter and on Facebook, everything looks roughly of equal importance.
Well, and let's talk about the news consumer. I've heard from people who are saying, I can't take this anymore. There's too much coming at me right now. It's very different than what I'm used to. How can news consumers decide what to take in and when to just take a day off and not pay attention to what's going on in Washington.
Right. And there are a couple of contradictory impulses, I think, that we've got to absorb and be smart enough to knit together. If you think about the opening days and weeks of the Obama administration, there was also incredible changes in government policy, changes in direction, and major actions taken and legislation proposed. Why was that? Well, we were in the throes of an unbelievable crisis. And, you know, it was a significant ideological shift in terms of the George W. Bush administration to Obama. In this case, there is no economic crisis. There are real issues affecting the country, but we're in a much steadier state than we have been in a long time. This is really about a shift in philosophy and a shift in gut instinct in the administration. Well, that means there's still an incredible amount of coverage and tumult. And I don't think it's useful for you to say, I've got to be online as much as possible to read everything I can. I think we have to winnow and be more selective at times about what sources we're going to rely on for information. Go to the ones we trust and then go to ones that may offer informed opinion and reporting that may in some ways contradict your own deeply held beliefs. If you're going to go to the fire hose of Google News and Facebook and Twitter and rely on that to tell you in perspective what's happening, I think you're going to be mistaken because there's going to be too much. You're not going to be able to grab – it's like trying to grab hold of a minnow during a major wave coming at you in the ocean. It's too much, and I think that you're going to have to pull back a bit, take time away from the TV and then say, all right, let me take an hour. Let me spend a little time with a couple of newspapers, a couple of newscasts, listen to NPR, go on to Facebook and maybe test a little bit. But let me make sure I'm testing my assumptions. Where am I getting news from? How are they sourcing information? Where are the original documents? How do I know what they're presenting? And I'm afraid that it's asking of us more than ever. And that's been continually true in the last years and decades. But I got to say right now, it sure feels stronger than ever.
And maybe sometimes just read a book.
Just read a book, for the love of God. Turn on Netflix. Takes a little time right. to deprogram because I think, you know, we're going to be in this for a while. There's going to be a lot of change for a good long time. As consumers, we got to pace ourselves. As journalists, we got to pace ourselves a bit. But, you know, that said, then you've got to embrace it.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.